Well, good morning, everybody. I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. You know, y'all could have had a real good speaker, but Damon ran out of numbers last night. And Bill and I was sitting over at Starbucks and having a cup of coffee before we set up our home group. And I got this call from Damon. He knows I wouldn't say no, but he ruined a good night's sleep last night because I didn't sleep a damn wink all night. That's honest God truth, because things go through my head. It always has. My sobriety date is September 15th, 2004. That's one of about four over the 24 years that I wandered in the wilderness, I should say. I have a sponsor. Bill and I coming over here, I told Bill, I might tell Leo's story. It's more interesting than mine, so, but I won't. I'll tell mine, but I sponsor folks. I have quite a few sponsees that I work with. I have a home group, the Depot group down by the college. I have a couple of other groups. I call them home groups because I work at those groups and help set them up. I know you're just supposed to have one, but I elect to have a few others. I found out that this is very important. The reason I share this, sponsorship, and I go to a lot of meetings. I try to work the steps in my life on a daily basis. And the reason that's so important, I didn't do that for years. I came into the program in 1980, and I had lost my family. That's the first of many families, unfortunately. I'll talk about those later. But I didn't do a lot of those things. I didn't share in meetings. I didn't have sponsees. I didn't go to a lot of meetings. And when I did, I'd sit there and I'd listen to folks and I'd say, I can't believe that shit. You know, they're making that up. I know when I was in treatment there in Charlotte and they'd put us on a bus and they'd take us to meetings out in Charlotte. And we'd be coming back on the bus and they'd be talking about, oh, that's so-and-so. I'd say, guys, they make that stuff up for us. You know, I don't think that really happens. But I found out later it does happen. And people are genuine. And I love this program. I love the people in it. It's actually saved my life in a number of times. A little bit about myself. I'm an Appalachian American. And I was born up above Asheville, North Carolina. I still have my family. That's where they live. I grew up in a cotton mill village. For those of you that don't know what that is, they found a source of labor there in the mountains. These entrepreneurs did years ago. I know my grandparents worked in the mills and my parents and most of the people I knew, but they would send bales of cotton up to, and they built a mill, and then they built a village for people to live in, and the mill owned the village. And so young couples getting married would move into the village, get a job at the mill, and by God, that's where they stayed, because you usually couldn't get out because everything was owned by the mill. And so it's a close-knit group, but they would ship bales of cotton in there, and they'd card the cotton and then spin it, and then they'd weave it, and they'd have cloth, and they'd send the cloth off. So that's what they did. My first wife worked in the mill. Most of my family, my mother, father, just about all my family worked there. But so it was close-knit, and everybody knew what was going on. I was born on D-Day, June 6, 1944, on the D-Day. My dad was in the Navy at the time. And the lady, we lived in it was a shotgun house. They had a family lived in one side and we lived in the other. And I remember Miss Fox lived in one side of the house. And my mother, I think she was about 16 or 17 at the time, and Miss Fox delivered me. I heard this story so much that my mama used to embarrass me. She said, nobody had a car around there then, so Miss Fox and another neighbor delivered me, and I was premature, so my mother said that when I came out, I looked like a wet wharf rat. Now, y'all, I kind of was weighing about 3 pounds. But anyhow, that was how I got started, and so I grew up there in the village. You know, my grandmother and grandfather, and my mother and dad, after he got out of the Navy, he got real religious. There was never any drinking in my home. I had 4 brothers, but my grandfather lived on the other side of the river. This French Broad River runs right through Asheville. And they lived way up in the holler there. They didn't even have a road up to the house. We'd have to go up the creek to get to their house. And he lived right at the head of the holler. And so I enjoyed staying there. It was not as complicated as the village. The village was not a real good place because you had different groups of guys, and there was a lot of homebrew and a lot of white liquor. And unfortunately, I started drinking real early, real young, and that's when everything got complicated. Prior to that, I can remember how life was so nice. It was I'd spend a lot of days up in the woods there above my grandmother's house, and it was just wonderful. But when I started drinking, and you just about had to drink if you stayed in a village there, because it was a peer pressure type thing, and the guys would, and this sounds awful, but it's the truth, they would get us younger guys drunk and make us fight. I used to tell, this one friend of mine, I'll share this and then I'll move on, but we called him Howdy Doody, and because he looked like Howdy Doody, if y'all remember what Howdy Doody looked like. But Larry was a good friend of mine. I hope he's not in here. I'd say, and I hated to drink that stuff, but I would usually try to spill it out if nobody was watching. And I'd say, Larry, just don't hit me in the face and we'll get through this. You know, I'd tell him because I knew they was going to make us fight. And sure enough, he'd hit me in the nose, boy, and it would make me crazy, and I'd whoop up on him. And I hated it. It was terrible. And I think if I had never had store-bought liquor, I'd never been an alcoholic, because I could not stand the white liquor. I couldn't stand the homebrew. But anyhow, I had another problem. I liked older women. And when I hit puberty, about 12 years old, and there's always a lot of older women in the village there, and I would fall in love all the time. And because you know, the parents of the people my age, of the girls especially, they wouldn't let us around them. They, you know, you were not allowed around those girls. So I started picking on the older women, and only, unfortunately, one of them had a husband, and she was about 16 and already had a baby. And I fell in love with blonde hair, blue eyed. God, she's pretty. And he snuck off. In a village, everybody sees you. They know where everybody's at, what they're doing. And I think somebody told him I was sneaking out of their house and everything. So he went to my dad and he said, "If you don't keep your son away from my wife, I'm going to kill him." So of course my dad just beat the heck out of me. My dad had some anger problems anyhow. But anyhow, if you had 5 boys, you'd have anger problems too. Especially, I look back at it now. My dad had some mental issues, like I say, he was real religious. My grandfather was an alcoholic, or he was drunk. He was sot. That's what my grandmother called him. And so my dad was kind of like his mother. They were just terribly religious. And but my dad had a nervous breakdown one time, and we didn't understand mental illness. Nobody did around there. We were ignorant of that type of thing. So we just put him in the back bedroom. And we'd take him up to county services, and he'd have shock treatments and everything, but he just kind of gave up on life. Well, I got this resentment that I carried till I was 60 years old, till I came back in the program this last time and really did the steps, about him just giving up on us, giving up on the family, because I had to go to work at seventh grade. And I worked and gave money to my parents, and I resented, or gave money to my mother, because I had younger brothers, but I resented that, and I really didn't understand, and I used to drink about it as I got older, which we alcoholics, we seek things to drink about. I never did understand it until I had the same type of issue myself, right before I came in this last time, and then I understood about mental illness. But anyhow, I did well in high school. I played football. I got out of high school, and our parents always told us, or my mother always told us, you know, they couldn't afford to send us to college, so go in the Navy. And then when you get out, if you want to go to college, you can on the GI Bill. So I went into the Navy and served 2 years on the same ship. Back then, we could serve. You could serve 4 years with 2 years inactive, or 2 years active and 4 years inactive. So that was before the Vietnam got started. I think the only thing our ship was involved in was the Cuban crisis in 1962. And so, when I got out of the Navy, I went to work as a lineman with AT&T, working on long lines between Hiram, Kentucky and Spartanburg, South Carolina, through the mountains there. And later, took a job as a repairman, and they put me on night shift, and that afforded me the opportunity to go to college. And I went to UNCA there in Asheville and graduated. I did real well. I had married the girl that I had gone to school with, not the lady out next door that had the husband that was going to kill me. I got away from that after my daddy whipped me. I said, no more of this. I graduated from college. I was drinking. I drank all through high school and the Navy, and I don't like to talk about my drinking. Y'all know how to drink. And you wouldn't have nothing else to do with me if I did tell you about my drinking, so you probably won't it now after I told you about the other things. But it caused me a lot of trouble, drinking did. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. Alcoholic had a connotation to it there when I grew up, and the church. I got away from the church. I got away from God. I stopped believing in God. When Dad got sick, and we couldn't understand it, none of my brothers or any of us, and the kids would come up to me and they'd say, well, what did your dad do that God made him try to kill himself, you know? And I couldn't figure it out either. And so I kind of turned off that belief in a higher power. I was skeptical of it anyhow, because some of the men in the village there that were alcoholics, we call them alcoholics because they were so bad, that would do things to their daughters they shouldn't do and beat their wives and things like that, and then go to church on Sunday and repent, and the preacher would forgive them. And I said, that's bullshit. You know, I can't believe that. But anyhow, that's how my agnostic temperament started, I guess you could call it that, and it caused me so much trouble over the years, not having a power greater than myself in my life, because I believe that what we accomplished in life was a result of how hard we worked and what we did. And I worked hard so hard that I neglected my family. I put my work first and my school first, and I did very well in my job and did very well in school. But I was not doing very well in my home life. I remember after I graduated, I took a plant manager's job in a small county up in North Carolina, and I had my employees over for dinner one night, and I was telling them that, you know, the job's important, but got to put your family first, and started all that stuff. Well, they left, my wife coming in, and she said, "You're the biggest son of a bitch I think I've ever run into." Said, "You tell those people to put their family first, and you never do that." And so I did, and I regret it. I look back at it now, but not knowing what alcoholic really was, and never wanting to be one, so I never admitted I was. I stayed in denial just about my whole life up until I was 60 years old. Our company started an employee assistance program in the late 70s, and they had a seminar up in Lenoir, North Carolina, and senior managers, we went to that seminar, and they taught us how to recognize alcoholics in our workplace. And I remember a bunch of us senior managers sitting around one night there in the room. You didn't have a bar back then, so you had to take the liquor to your room, and we was discussing how those people that worked for us were alcoholics, you know, some of them. And every one of us was full blown. I look back at it now. I ended up later on, after my family left, going to treatment there in Charlotte, and thinking I could get my family back. When you neglect your family, Maria, I was married 3 times to beautiful women. I loved them dearly. That I just messed up. I was an alcoholic. My relationship skills were not what they should have been. But anyhow, I went into treatment there in Charlotte first of many times, and when I got out, it didn't happen. I didn't get my family back. So I stayed sober a couple of years. I'd go to meetings. I still didn't believe in God. I still thought that people embellished their stories when they shared, you know, to make it sound good for the group. I could never be honest with myself. When I started lying, I mentioned when I was young and first started drinking, my life got complicated. It got complicated because that's when you have to start lying. It's when you start drinking. And I never had to lie prior to that. I was never forced to. So I became a liar. And that was just one of my wonderful traits, I guess. But anyhow, I lasted a couple of years. I stayed sober for a couple of years, and my life was good. I started drinking again. I chose to start drinking again, and things started getting bad. So a job came open in Atlanta, and I figured I was going to find out about me sooner or later there in Charlotte. So I moved to Atlanta, And I got down here and I couldn't stop drinking. I was living over we call it EPLC over at Druid Hills, and so I was drinking every day and trying to work too. And one weekend I got real bad, and I said, like, I got to call somebody. I called central office, and they sent me to the Biscayne room, So I went up to the Biscayne room, and they kept me up there that night, and give me some orange juice and tender loving care, and kept me there that night. I met a guy that started sponsoring me, and I became pretty active over there on the other side of town in AA, and I still didn't believe in God. I still didn't believe in the. I still, deep down inside, didn't want to admit I was an alcoholic. So, of course, it didn't work. But I did stay in the program 7 years. My sponsor at the time got me started back running. That became a therapy for me. We started running marathons, and we'd go up to Washington, run the Marine Corps, and Atlanta. And I was running somewhere every week. And then I was down in Jacksonville, and I was running with this group, and I fell in love again. It was awful. And so here I was, sober again, life going good. Ended up getting married again. So got married and moved to Marietta. Took a job in Marietta. And everything was going good in my life. I started going to the Howe place when it was down there on 92, where you had to take your clothes off when you got home, put them in the dryer to get the cigarette smoke out of them. So it was over a hardware store or something down. Y'all know where I'm talking about. And so I would go there and to the Rebos and a couple other places, but I didn't go regular. And like I said earlier on, I didn't sponsor anyone. I didn't share a lot. I kept my feelings to myself. I just didn't want to admit I was an alcoholic. I was not honest. And so I was driving home one day, and you know, people talk about slipping. You don't have a slip. You know, a slip's something women used to wear. But I chose to drink. You know, I just made a decision one day going home. There's this place there in Cherokee Street called Cantrell's. It used to have, and my wife and I used to go in there and get a hamburger sometime. They had good food. But they also had beer in a mug about that high, and it was pretty. You know, it was just cold and on a hot day, and for some reason that pretty beer got in my head one day at work. My office was on the square there in Marietta, there on Powder Springs Street. And so when I got in my company car and started driving home, I went to Cantrell's and had a beer. And it got it all started again. Now, the lady I married, her father had been an alcoholic, and we talked, and she knew I was in the program. And she said, "Well, I'll tell you, if you ever start drinking again, Mike, I'll leave you." She said, "I cannot live with that in my life again, because my father was in the military and he was an alcoholic." So it started, and this is when I started hiding it, you know. Hell, I'd be out there mowing the grass, and I'd have it hid in the bushes, and she'd say, "How in the hell can you go out there and mow the grass and come in here drunk? You know, you know, where are you getting the liquor?" You know, she couldn't understand it, and so I'd have it hid everywhere, so I was up in Hendersonville, North Carolina, one weekend with a group of guys playing golf. She loved for me to go play golf. She really encouraged me to. And she was a runner too, so we ran a lot, had a lot in common. And I came home and everything was changed around. There was the furniture in the basement had been put up in the living room, and all the nice furniture was gone. And my stepson was there, and I said, "Scott," I said, "what's going on?" He said, "You need to talk to Mother about that." So she had left me. She said she would. So I said, "Well, that gave me the opportunity to drink more, you know, not have to hide it. I can put it out, put it in nice decanters and make it look pretty, you know, put it on my counter and everything." And so I did that. And so, so then I rocked along there, and everything was going pretty good and everything. And I met another girl, fell in love this time. And I had been, what had happened that had caused me to, I was working with a vendor, one of my vendors, and his wife introduced me to this lady, and I started dating her, and things started going real well. And then I retired from the company I was with, took early retirement, and went with another company, and it was in sales. And our office was out in Seattle, Everett, Washington. So I was drinking quite heavily and at the time, and she knew it, and she would drink also. But the when the economy went bad in 2000, they laid everybody off, and so I didn't have a job there for a little while, and things got real bad, and I got pancreatitis, and I had gotten pancreatitis years ago with my first wife. I was drinking real bad, and I'll go back and just explain this, but I had an office in Statesville, North Carolina, and I was in my office there, and I was in my mid-30s, and I started having real bad pains, and I thought I had a heart attack. And so they rushed me to the hospital, and I had the doctor put me in intensive care. And then he brought my wife in after they kind of got me, I guess they could drive me out, is what they did. And he said, you have pancreatitis. And my wife said, well, what is that? He said, that's caused by acute alcoholism. I said, hell, I ain't no alcoholic. And so to show you what a liar I was, and this was with my first wife and everything, my mother and dad, I told them I had a heart attack. And I told everybody I had a heart attack. My wife used to say, well, why are you telling everybody you got a heart attack? You're an alcoholic. I said, no, I'm not an alcoholic. I had a heart attack. And my mother and daddy died thinking I had heart trouble, you know, so I, just that lying. But anyhow, when the economy went bad in around 2000, 1999, 2000, it started again. And I ended up having to go to the hospital. And I ended up going three times in a period of a year. The third time, I told Dr. Sheftel, I said, you know, when I get out this time, I'm going to go back to AA. I said, I know about AA. I know what I got to do. He said, well, you're not getting out. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you don't have any family here, so I've signed the papers. So the Cobb County took me to Peachford, and they committed me. And so having gone there, I'm trying to find out what time it is, having gone there, and then the lady I was dating, I started back to AA after I got out of Peachford, and we ended up getting married. And we were married 3 years, and then I started drinking again. I was in Florida. We was down there on business, and I was at South Beach with my boss, and that, you know, you've heard people say this. I said, they were drinking wine. I said, I'm just going to have a glass of wine, and to myself. And so I did, and nothing happened. I had a glass of wine. But that's when I first understood about that obsession. I couldn't get it out of my mind. The whole time I was there, another week. After that, I didn't drink anymore while I was there, but I couldn't get that out of my mind about drinking. And so on the plane back, that's all I could think about. So I was living over there off of McDobbs Road in Kennesaw, and I was coming up 41, and I stopped there at the Dixie Package Store and got a half gallon of vodka. And that was in 2003. And I stayed drunk for 9 months. That was my last drunk. I couldn't stop. That's the only time, you know, they talk about the four horsemen. And Tara was the big one, but despair. That's the first time in my life I ever wanted to stop drinking, and I wanted it so bad, but I couldn't. No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't. I tried praying, but you know, it wasn't sincere. I just wanted to stop drinking, and I couldn't. And it was getting worse. I started hurting again. I knew I was gonna get back in that same situation with the pancreatitis, and then some events happened between me and my wife and me and my stepkids, and I ended up in jail, facing some felony assault charges and stuff like that, and I was in a whole lot of trouble. And my kids came down from Asheville and got me out of jail, and I moved into a motel down there off 75. where I lived for 2 years. It was a good place to live. If y'all ever lived in a motel like that, you can step one step, and you can be in your bedroom, or you can be in your kitchen, or you can be in your living room. Just like that. No, I say it jokingly, but when I got out of jail and moved in there, they say a short prayer pierces the heavens. That short prayer that I had was, God, I need some help. Because I was at my wit's end. I asked him, I had taken the steps and I'd worked the steps. I knew all about it. I knew about the third step. But I didn't believe in God. But at that point in time in my life, that's the only place I could go to is God. And I asked him, I said, I'm not asking you to make all this go away. but if you'll help me this time, I'll do whatever it takes. I'll become willing. I kind of get emotional when I talk about this because it was the most emotional time in my life because I'm not an emotional person, but I can remember sobbing uncontrollably just about all night. I couldn't stop. That shame and everything that I was going through, that despair. I mean, if you've been there, you know what I'm talking about. Despair when you think there's nothing else in your life. Here I was not in a house. I had no home. I was not allowed to go back. I was getting ready to go through another divorce. My kids really didn't want me coming up there or being around the grandkids because I couldn't stop drinking. They'd already told me that during that 9 month period I was drinking. They said they didn't want me around, so they didn't. So I had a lot of bad thoughts. But I asked God if He would just help me stop drinking. And He did. But I got a sponsor that just went out. He's over in another town. He called me this week and he said, I can't stop drinking. I pray to God all the time. I say, but God's not going to answer your prayer unless you do something. God will give you the will to get sober, but He's not going to strike you sober. It just don't happen. So I asked God, I said, if you'll just help me stop drinking, not making all this stuff go away, I'll do whatever it takes. And things started happening in my life. I started making better decisions. Almost immediately, I called, I checked into Richview because I knew I couldn't stop. I got in their outpatient intensive program, or whatever you call it, and the thoughts I was having was not good. I worked downtown. I was contracting back with a company at that time, and I'd see trucks alongside the road, and I'd say, well, if I just hit that truck going this fast, then my kids won't think I killed myself. And I'd get to work and I'd say, this is not right. So I called a psychiatrist. And between going to a psychiatrist and going to Ridgeview and come to AA meetings, things started happening in my life better. That relationship with a God of my understanding, I look back over all the years that, I was 60 years old when all this was going on. That's 14 years ago. I'm 74 now. And that relationship that's developed over the past few years with God, the God that I understand, is what was missing my whole life. I look back at all the things and decisions I made, the way I treated people. When I started working the steps, I did that third step. That was the most profound thing I've ever done in my life. was when I made the decision that I was going to start believing in God of my understanding and try to do His will. That was the most profound thing that's ever happened to me. And it opened up the door for the rest of the steps for me to work those. And I did my fourth step, and I finally got honest. And the fifth step was something I had trouble with the whole time. I could not imagine sitting down in front of another man and sharing the things that was causing me to act out all my life. That fear, you know, how do you tell a man you're fearful of everything? You know, you're fearful. And I acted out as a kid, and all my life I acted out of fear. And so when I finally got to that point, and I was slowing down on my fourth step, I was down there, and my sponsor said, you've been on that fourth step too long. He said, I've made you an appointment out Conyers at the monastery for you to do your fifth step this Saturday. I said, what do you mean at the monastery? I'm Baptist. That's a Catholic place. So, anyhow, I went out there that Saturday, and I sat down with Brother Michael, and I unloaded, buddy, and it gave me some serenity. It gave me some peace. I left there with peace. And then my sponsor took me up there to there's a little lake down there off of Barrett Parkway called Barrett Lakes. And we went down there that next Saturday, and I did my sixth and seventh step with him there. And we did a seventh step prayer. The seventh step helped me so much because I felt so less than. I felt like a piece of shit. And I realized that I'm just no better and I'm no worse than anybody else. That I'm Mike Player. I'm just Mike. I'm who I am. All those defects of character that I identified are part of me. They're never going to leave me. You know, I acted out on them all those years. But when I finally realized that in the seventh step that, you know, I have to have a God in my life, that He loves me, whether He loves me with all of my defects of character. I call them factory defects. They were there to start with. But He loves me. And that gave me a foundation to go ahead and do 8 and 9. Now, that's when I actually, my dad was dead. And having gone through some of the same thing he did, you know, he tried to kill himself. I thought about it. I probably would have tried it had God not intervened. So I was able to make peace with that after all those years. And that was a very emotional time for me. I did it by myself with my dad, who was dead, but we did it. I understood him. I understood why he withdrew into himself like he did. Because he was sick, and we didn't understand that. And thank God today, you know, we're open. AA is open to medical help. You know, if you need it, you get it. AA just can't give you everything. You have to go. We have to seek medical help. But anyhow, that got me on to the 8th and 9th step. Now, there's 3 wives that's probably not going to forgive me for anything, but that's not the point. I forgive myself, and I'm willing for them to forgive me. My children's mother, we get along well. But today I work 10, 11, 12 on a regular basis because what God so freely gave me when I asked for it, I try to help other people understand how they can get the same thing. Having gone through what I went through, I'm able to share some of that stuff that I did, the things that, how I acted out, how I treated people. You know, I've had to learn how to to do everything all over again in my life the last 14 years, and I'm still learning, and I'm not perfect, and just to share something with you, this is kind of funny, and then I'm going to hush, but I went through, I got my house back after all those years. I went through all the courts. It took me 4 years to get through all of the courts with the aggravated assault, the civil case that was brought against me for pain and suffering, the mental anguish, the divorce, and all that stuff. So when I finally got my house back, because I had a prenuptial agreement when I got married that last time. Well, I was doing some work in my house this past week, and I found this shoebox up in the corner of one of the closets in the bedroom. It had been covered up with a bunch of stuff and towels and stuff like that, and it was from 2004. And it was the stuff that my wife had left, my last wife had left, when she had to leave the house. When I got out of the motel and was able to go back to my home. And I opened it up, and here was all these pictures of our wedding. We had a nice wedding, and my family had come down and was there at the wedding. And then all the brochures of the place we'd went to on our honeymoon. And here was a check for a lot of money. It was my half of the savings account. Hell, this was 2004. I should have went and cashed it, but no, I didn't. But, because we'd already settled that in here, so I tore that up. But here was a scathing letter. It was, and it said, there at the end of it, it said, "I wish I had known what type of person you was before I married you." So it hurt me there for a minute or two, and I thought about it, and I said, "Well, hell, we dated 12 years. She should have known what kind of person I was." So it kind of laughed, but it's a lot of truth in that. I wish I had known what type. I wish I had the wherewithal to have recognized what type of person I was, but I didn't, and it took what it took. I'm learning to be a better person. I've learned that in this program. I've learned it from y'all. When I came in and things were so bad, and I would share in the meetings, and Damon was there, and especially on Sunday morning, and over at the Seventh-day Adventist Church and everything, and everybody would tell me, just take it a day at a time and trust in God. And I have. And I still live my life a day at a time. And I still trust in God. I love the relationship I have with the people in the program. I love the people in the program, and they saved my life. They tolerated me, and you know, when you come in and you're full of so much shame, and you for what you've done and the way you've acted and the way you've treated people and your family, it's just amazing how people, you know, love you and forgive you. You know, my family didn't even want me around my grandchildren. I've got a great-grandbaby now, but they didn't even want me around back when I was going through that 9 months. And it's like they've forgotten all that. They forgot how I was. It's just our relationship now is just wonderful. So it is an honor and a privilege to share my story with you, and I appreciate you listening, and God bless all of you. Thank you.